Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. More than a year into the pandemic, issues in the global supply chain are causing shortages across the country. Surging demand is to blame in some cases, but in others, there are issues in the supply chain that could persist beyond 2021. Ahead on Insight, we'll take a look at the supply chain issues and how it's playing out in California, home to one of the world's top distribution hubs. And you've heard a lot about how the pandemic has touched, practically every aspect of life as we know it. Well, nature and wildlife are no different, especially in a state like California. A chief scientist for the World Wildlife Fund helps us understand the many ways COVID has affected both, coming up, from migrational patterns and animal relocations to disrupted research and conservation efforts. But first, Cap Radio is launching a new 7-part podcast series called After the Assault, covering the consequences of sexual assault, the broken justice system, and the healing process. It's been some 2 years in the making. Joining us now to talk about After the Assault is host and Cap Radio healthcare reporter, Sammy Cayola. Welcome to Insight.
Hey, Vicky. Thanks so much for having me.
Well, it's been a lot of work on your front and your entire teams. Can you just tell us about After the Assault and how the idea for the series came together?
This is actually kind of an amazing origin story. We got an email more than 2 years ago from a survivor who listens to Cap Radio, who just wanted to tell us about what happened when she reported a rape to the Sacramento Police Department. And, you know, when you talk to reporters, they'll often tell you, oh, yeah, I got this tip in my inbox. I got this cold phone call, you know, and we don't always follow them, you know, or sometimes we try to follow them and they fall apart. But Nick Miller actually got the email. He's Cap Radio's managing editor of news, and he brought it to me, and he said, I really think we should look into this, and I'd really like a female reporter on the story. And so he and I got together. We talked about it. It was just sort of off the tail of the Me Too movement, which sexual harassment, sexual assault are very different issues, but it was a time when, you know, we felt that the voices of people who've been harmed really needed to be elevated, and we really needed to start believing people's stories. And I said, well, I want to hear hers. And so we brought this person in and we sat with them, and Nick and I were both just completely taken aback by what she had to say. And we wanted to know whether she was an outlier or whether these were systemic problems. And so we just dug into it over the next couple of months. And we actually put together what ended up being an all-woman reporting team. And it just was important to us to let the survivor's voice lead the story. We were looking at a lot of media coverage of rape and sexual assault that was not really about the person who had been harmed and what their experiences were and what the long-term impacts were for them. The coverage we saw was just about the incident, what happened, who the perpetrator was, what happened to the perpetrator. And we just really wanted to turn the table on that.
Well, how did your lens as a healthcare reporter shape the way you approached this series?
Well, being a healthcare reporter actually really put a wrench in my finishing this series because I was in the middle of reporting it. So we started actually in July 2019. We did a ton of reporting between December 2019 and the spring of 2020, and we had really good material that we were ready to start putting together, and then the pandemic hit. And I had to become Cap Radio's lead COVID reporter. So we went on this big hiatus. But fortunately, we were able to pick it up after about an 8-month pause. So being the healthcare reporter during all this was kind of a lot. But I will say that, you know, sexual assault is not squarely a health story, but it does have so much impact on people's mental well-being. And I have a lot of experience reporting on people who've been through trauma. I did a Cap Radio series in 2018 that was all about suicide. One of my first works as a journalist was about Black child death. And so I am pretty accustomed to interviewing people who have been through very difficult things. So I was interested in taking this on and also knew I was going to have a ton to learn. Interviewing survivors is not like interviewing any other kind of trauma victim. And so it's still, though, it's a person battling a system, which is very common in the medical world, right? As a healthcare reporter, I talk to people all the time that feel like they have no agency over their medical problems, whether it's an insurance company or a hospital. You know, I'm used to looking at systems and where systems fail.
Well, before we dive into the series, what resonated with you most? Because obviously we're talking with survivors and powerful accounts, but there's also a good amount of investigative work and actually looking at data. I guess in the past 2 years, what surprised you most when it comes to what justice can or cannot look like?
Just off the bat, how rare justice is in these cases. We started just by looking at national numbers, and the biggest study we found, which is from Wellesley, you know, showed that less than 2% of reported rapes end up in trial. You know, and I think we just all see sexual assault on television and we assume there's this big investigation and people go to court and they tell their stories, and it's just not usually what happens. And so we did end up getting arrest rates for our local police departments, which you'll hear if you tune into episode one of the podcast. But yeah, the arrest rates are pretty low. And then even if someone's arrested, that doesn't mean that it's going to be going to court or that anyone will be incarcerated. So, you know, it was just sort of letting those numbers wash over us and say, okay, well then what do you do if you're a survivor and you know your chances are so slim? I was also really surprised to learn about sanctuary harm. It's a term I'd never heard before. It basically means the places that are meant to give you sanctuary, whether that's a police department, a hospital, a school, that they can end up causing further damage when you go to seek help. And that was an experience that multiple people I interviewed had, that they went to report this crime to law enforcement and they walked away feeling that they were not believed. They walked away feeling blamed. They walked away feeling let down. And they're recovering from rape, but they're also recovering from this kind of second trauma of the interaction they had. So that all really blew my mind.
There are 7 episodes in total. What topics will be covered?
Many, 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 many topics. We start with this concept of start by believing. It's a phrase that's used to try to encourage law enforcement to take survivors seriously from the get-go. So the first episode is about kind of just that initial reaction when you give a report. And really the first 4 episodes dig really deeply into the reporting process. So that goes from making your report to getting a medical exam, to what the interview can be like, to what your case outcome might be. But I want to be really clear, so many survivors don't report. We know that about 3/4 of rape cases nationally go unreported, or it's an estimate, right? Because we don't know everyone who doesn't report. But we didn't want this series to just be focused on law enforcement outcomes and the law enforcement process. So the last 3 episodes are about just the experience of living as a survivor. So they're about rape trauma syndrome, which you'll hear about in episode 5. They're about being a good ally and also how to prevent sexual assault and sexual violence, how to end rape culture. And, you know, we wanted to make sure a lot of the series also looked at alternatives, looked at solutions, both what law enforcement could do to improve the existing system, and also what would happen if we moved away from that system? What would alternatives to policing look like? So the series takes a little bit of a turn in that direction toward the end.
I really love how the series is also a collaboration with survivors. I mean, when I was listening to parts of it, I just felt so grateful that they allowed us into such intimate spaces in their life. Can you just explain how involved they were in the final product and how different this was, a different approach this was in reporting?
This is an extremely different journalistic process. I had never done anything like this before. And I have to give a major shout out right now to Jessica Maria Ross, who handles community engagement. She actually directed this whole podcast. But from the get-go, she and I went in with this participatory journalism approach, which basically means the people at the center of your story help create your story. And that's not usually how it works. Usually you interview someone and you say, okay, thank you. I'm going to go. I'm going to write this. And then you'll see it in a day or a week or a month. And here's what I wrote. And the person you interviewed doesn't really have a lot of say in what happens there. With these survivors, we knew that we couldn't recreate the power dynamic that they had been through with other systems, because the media is a system, right? I do have power as a journalist to decide what happens with this material. But I didn't want them to be in the dark, and I didn't want them to feel nervous I needed them to trust me, really, is what it came down to. And it takes time to build that trust. And so what Jessica did was create a safe space for them. So we had 8 survivors who made up this cohort that you hear about all through the podcast. And we invited them into CAP Radio and we let them set the ground rules for what they wanted to talk about and where the boundaries should be. And we let them ask us questions. We showed them the episode outline and said, what do you think of these episodes? What would you add? What would you take out? Episode 7 actually exists because a survivor pitched that idea and we loved it. And, you know, we just really had to help survivors feel safe and feel like they had some agency in the work for them to be able to open up and talk to us the way that they did. So it was a total revolution for me. I think it's an amazing way to connect with people. It definitely does flip the journalistic tradition on its head a little bit. We also did things like asking survivors to interview each other in a group recording setting. And because they had so much common ground and they wanted to talk about stuff that I never would have thought to ask them. And we also had them interview their own loved ones. So that is just the kind of really enlightening and intimate material that you're going to hear.
Yeah, it really is just a humbling approach and being aware of our own blind spots and letting the subject, letting survivors guide what now is just such a powerful podcast. Throughout this journey that you went through as a reporter, what challenges did you and your team run into?
Building that trust was probably the biggest one. Survivors were wary of us at first. You know, they didn't know exactly what we were going to do with the material. They were, you know, just a little unsure what working with a journalist would be like. So getting through that, creating something collaborative. The data element was really, really difficult. We knew we needed to show that this was a broader problem and that there were areas for improvement in the law enforcement process. And to do that, we needed a bunch of records. Emily Zentner, our data reporter, filed 30 record requests over the 2-year period. And many of them, we didn't get them back or they were incomplete. So kind of finding ways to work with what we had was a big challenge. And then also walking this line between, you know, holding law enforcement accountable for what's not working, while also highlighting what is working. There are some local departments that are changing the way they do things, or they've maybe always had good protocols, and we did want to be able to lift that up. And also to even get law enforcement to want to engage with this project, we had to go in, you know, saying that, look, we do want to tell all sides of this story, and we do want to know what you're doing. We do want to know what you think is going well and what you think can be improved. So it was finding a way to tie that all together and also to shine light on problems without discouraging people from reporting. So again, it is always a survivor's choice whether they want to report or not, and it is absolutely fine if you don't want to report. But the more people who report, the more theoretically DNA evidence gets entered into the system. Even if your case doesn't go anywhere, it could help solve future cases down the line. So, you know, there is a movement within law enforcement to try to really become approachable and really encourage people to come forward. So the difficulty was just, yeah, walking that line and finding the balance between all of those elements. Yeah.
I also love that the series, you know, wraps around, you know, from the trauma and the challenges to also a roadmap of resources. Can you tell us about those?
This was a huge lift for the CAP Radio team, but I'm so glad we were able to do it. This is our digital component of our podcast. It is basically a step-by-step for what it would look like if you were to go report a sexual assault. And we heard from the beginning from survivors that they couldn't find this when they looked for it. They described it as like disaster planning. Like, you know what to do if it's a wildfire and you have to evacuate. But you might not know what to do if you just got raped and you don't know who to call maybe, and you don't know what you should do with yourself and you're in shock. So whether this is you or whether it's a loved one that you're trying to help, we tried to set up something that was, you know, interactive and easy to engage with, that would walk you through the process, that also includes a glossary of terms that you might hear. And those include terms that are not even part of the law enforcement process, just terms that have to do with healing and the trauma of assault. And there is also a community directory of organizations that work with sexual violence survivors. And we thought this was really important because, so Sacramento has a rape crisis center. It's called WEAVE, and I'm going to give the phone number for it in a moment. We also know, though, that there are tons of smaller community-based organizations that work with marginalized communities, you know, that work with LGBTQ survivors and survivors of color and non-English speaking survivors. And we wanted to make sure that you could find those groups if you, you know, had a special cultural need that you wanted to address and that you just needed a safe place to go. So we have a big directory with everybody's phone numbers on our website, capradio.org/after. But let me just really quickly give the WEAVE phone number in case anyone needs it. This is Sacramento's Rape Crisis Center. It's 24/7 if you have, you know, you need any kind of assistance for you or a loved one. I'm going to give it twice. It's 916-920-2952. That's 916-920-2952.
I love that you have all of those resources in such an easily accessible way and that roadmap. You know, in addition to if someone is a victim of rape or sexual assault and having these resources, there's also resources and advice to allies as well, and an episode devoted to loved ones who are caring for individuals that are going through this.
That's episode 6, and we felt really strongly about including that. A lot of the survivors in the group conversations where they were all relating to each other, they had experiences where they went to tell a friend or tell a family member, and they just didn't get the support that they were looking for. They either felt, you know, that just nobody really took them that seriously. They also had issues where, you know, months and years after this trauma, they were still struggling, you know? They were still maybe not the way they used to be. They've all changed in really major ways. They might not want to do all of the things that they used to do, and they don't interact with people the same way. They might be moodier or, you know, a little more hot and cold. They might need more alone time. And they just felt like their friends and family just weren't getting that. And they were asking them, like, why aren't you over this yet? Why are you still stuck on this? Which is a really problematic question to ask a survivor, because there is no timeline. There's no finish goal. There's no, like, I'm healed now, I'm fine, I'm over it. That really doesn't happen. So the best that you can do to be a good ally is to just be really patient and just try to ask them what they need and do whatever that is. And so we wanted to lay that out in an episode. We also wanted to do an episode about, even if you think you don't know any survivors, you probably do, 1 in 5 U.S. women is a victim of attempted or completed assault. There's a lot that we can all do just in changing the way we talk about sexual violence and changing the way we treat each other and asking for consent and thinking about the way we take up space and just creating room for people to talk about this. So episode 7 is really all about, what can you do? What are little day-to-day things that just you, an average person who maybe hasn't been through this, what can you do?
Finally, before we let you go, listeners are going to start listening today. What do you hope everyone takes away from after the assault?
Yeah, that's such a tough question. I had to answer this in episode 7, and then I had to write it, and I was like, oh, what am I going to say here? Because it's so much. I think that last piece that I just talked about everyone having a role here. Sexual violence is a community problem. I mean, it's instigated by individual perpetrators, but it really is the responsibility of an entire community to A, try to provide support to people who have been harmed, and B, try to prevent this from happening in the future. So I think of this as an issue that you're not well read up on. And full disclosure, I wasn't before I started reporting this project. This is a really good way to get yourself up to speed, because it's really important. Because if it doesn't affect you, it definitely affects someone in your life. And it could affect you in the future. So I would just say, if you have some time to listen and read, CAP Radio has tons of resources, and we also point you to national and local resources where you can even get involved in this on the ground. You know, rape crisis centers always need donations. They always need volunteers. There are plenty of ways to become active on this issue.
That is CAP Radio healthcare reporter Sammy Kayola, the host of the new podcast series, After the Assault. You can start listening today and throughout the week. We have also a guide for reporting a sexual assault, like Sammy was discussing, a glossary of terms, supporting organizations at capradio.org/after. And then you could start listening to the podcast wherever you get your podcasts, or you can head to capradio.org/after the assault. Sammy, such a pleasure having you this morning.
Thanks so much, Vicki.
Well, up next, global supply chain issues are causing shortages across the country. How's that playing out in California? You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, CAP Radio. I'm Vicki Gonzalez.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. What do bubble tea, consumer electronics, and construction materials have in common? All are industries affected by supply chain glitches. Between COVID, trade wars, the Suez Canal blockage, cyber attacks, I mean, it's been a year unlike any other for the people and the companies charged with managing these massive global networks. For most of us, that means shortages. New cars, farm machinery, just about anything with a computer chip in it, and apparently bubble tea as well. Surging demand is partly to blame, but so are miscalculations and vulnerabilities in the global supply chain. Jennifer Smith covers logistics and supply chains for The Wall Street Journal. She's been following the story all year and joins us now. Welcome to Insight, Jennifer.
Hi there.
Well, Jennifer, let's just break down what exactly a supply chain is and the importance that it carries.
Sure. So supply chain is basically the end-to-end process of making and selling goods. So that's everything from the supply of raw materials, metals, things that you would use for manufacturing, the manufacturing process itself. And then, of course, once you have a finished product, the transportation, distribution, and sale of that product. So it's sourcing, it's production, it's the movement of goods sort of from the origination point to the final destination or the end customer. And that customer, depending on which supply chain you're looking at, could be a factory, it could be a retail store, or increasingly, particularly this year, it's straight to consumers' homes.
Well, early in the pandemic, there were shortages of toilet paper and webcams as people were working from home. How has these supply chain issues evolved since the beginning of the pandemic?
So you're right. As you said in your intro, it has been a year or even 15, 16 months like no other. So, and the pandemic shifted consumption in a number of ways, both in terms of product demand, which has changed as we've gone through the period, and also in the way people bought things. So at the beginning, people were on the consumer end, people were stockpiling on all this stuff you need to shelter at home. So that's toilet paper, you know, frozen foods, canned soup, and lots of home office gear, gym supplies. And then as it became clear things were going to stay this way for a while, you saw people buying more furniture and fixing up their homes. Sales of suits and office wear went down and leisure wear went up. Then on the backside, the lockdowns that were meant to control the spread of COVID, which of course were happening globally in a little bit of a staggered fashion, starting in China, which is the factory floor for much of the goods that are sold around the world. So this threw manufacturing for a loop. Companies were trying to figure out, you know, they had to shut their production down or rearrange production to make it safe, but they're also trying to figure out what kind of demand there would be for their products in the face of a global pandemic, which was, and as you mentioned, not all of these calculations went as planned. And so you might have something like Hertz had some trouble and they ended up selling off vehicles because no one was renting vehicles, very few people were traveling. Now that's also fed into a shortage of used cars, which is coming about as there's a shortage of new cars because semiconductors, which are sort of one of the stars of this moment in terms of shortages, semiconductors are used so much to make autos as well as for gaming consoles and computers and phones and the things you might expect it. So it's really spread out. And there was a whole, you know, then there's a food supply chain, which had very big disruptions between the kinds of things that are sold at retail for people to cook in their homes and the quantities and types of goods that are sold to food service customers and restaurants. And there was a huge disruption to that during the shutdowns that is now having a reverse moment. And some struggles are coming as people are leaving the house more and they're traveling and eating out. And it's hard to get chicken wings and hot dogs for some suppliers.
I mean, I think what you're just describing is so many steps in a process to get from, you know, from production to a consumer. And obviously that opens itself up to lots of opportunities for snags, especially when you're dealing with a year unlike or 15 months unlike any other over, you know, the past year and a half. So because of the pandemic, when looking at like the Port of Los Angeles, which is the busiest in the country, Port of Long Beach isn't far behind. You know, they're just coming out with cargo records. But I would imagine that's also stressing the supply chain as well.
Right. Transportation, whether it's by ship or by air or by truck, is a really key part of the supply chain. And back at the beginning, when factories in China had extended shutdowns, a lot of the shipping companies canceled many of their sailings that would usually take products to the West Coast. And you mentioned the port complex of LA and Long Beach. It's a really busy US gateway. It's probably the biggest gateway for trade from Asia into the US. So once it became clear that people were still buying things when they were at home and things, raw materials were still needed, there was a lot. By even, I think, mid to late summer, you started getting ships stacking up and you had this crush of imports coming in because companies were trying to restock inventories that had been depleted during the pandemic. They're also getting ready for the holiday season. So you had a lot of factors coming. And then there was the labor piece as Southern California was wrestling with rising coronavirus cases in the fall and the winter. That means fewer dock workers are on hand to unload the ships. That's going to slow things down. And that's also going to hit the warehouse piece. So your end result is you had retailers or manufacturers waiting for weeks on end. Their goods weren't in China. Their goods were stuck at, you know, on ships off the port, or they were stuck at the port. And that threw a whole bunch of calculations off. Now that backlog is easing somewhat, but there have been bottlenecks at other major US seaports, and that's all putting a drag on supply chains. That's even before we get to the part of the trucking piece, which is how to actually move these goods once they get in the country, how they're moving around the US.
Yeah, I mean, there's so many arms to this. How does that translate into the cost for the consumer? Is that contributing to an uptick in cost or inflation?
You are seeing a number of customer companies raising prices, and whether or not that translates immediately into a sticker price sort of depends on the product, but prices are going up. You are seeing this across the board, and that's happening as you see in company earnings reports. Everything from when their prices for raw materials and transport rise, often these are going to get passed along, and that is what's happening to a large degree right now.
Finally, Jennifer, what are the lessons learned over the past 15 months when it comes to supply chain issues?
So there's been a lot of talk about just-in-time which is a strategy of, I'm oversimplifying it, but a strategy of trying to keep your inventories fairly lean so that you don't have big back rooms full of dusty boxes of parts that aren't going to get used for months. You want to have stuff coming in right when you need it, then you can get stuff out the door. And when everything is working fine, that can help keep costs down. Now that we have global supply chains, as you pointed out, you have a web stretching, you know, from Asia to Canada, Mexico, the US, things are moving across, and there's also some potential for errors. So one thing that we are seeing is that businesses are looking at, they're not throwing that out the window, but they are seeing the necessity of having safety stock. You can't have a whole warehouse full of toilet paper, but you certainly might want to make sure you've got safety stock of key materials on which your business really depends. So that's even affecting the industrial real estate market as folks make plans to have a little bit more space to hold these products so that they're not caught out as they were when you get this sort of unprecedented global demand shock that we saw during the pandemic.
Jennifer Smith covers logistics and supply chains for The Wall Street Journal. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Well, you're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. And if you're just joining us, we're talking about the damaging issues in the global supply chain and how it's playing out in California, home to one of the world's top distribution hubs, more than a year into the pandemic. With that, Willie Shi is an economist with Harvard Business School and joins us now. Welcome to Insight, Willie.
Well, thank you, Vicky. Glad to join you.
So how significant is California in the context of this global conversation about supply chain issues?
Well, Vicky, as you pointed out, California is really a major import hub. Los Angeles, Long Beach, for example, for ocean shipments, it's around half of the import trade from Asia. From there, it gets distributed mostly by truck to the western states. Anything east of the Rockies, it goes by intermodal rail, right? So you have carriers like Union Pacific and BNSF who are major haulers of freight to Midwest distribution centers. So California really does serve as a hub in that respect. So right now, for example, we're seeing a lot of congestion in the intermodal rail yards in the Midwest, especially around the Chicago area, for, you know, all the big box stores have their Midwestern distribution there, and that's backing up all the way into California. So we're all interconnected here and interdependent.
Well, with that said, that interconnectedness, I mean, we live in a world where we're looking at a product, but, you know, the reality is that it can be made up of components from multiple continents. What are the benefits of this massive global supply chain, and also within the past 15 months, the challenges that arise from depending on that interconnectedness?
Well, Vicky, the benefits are that we can specialize. In other words, some companies, some countries are better at doing some things, and others are better at doing other things. And that is the benefit of trade. You do what you're good at, I do what I'm good at, and then we trade and we're all better off. Okay, as technology has gotten much more complex, it has required much more specialization. So, for example, in semiconductors, which you talked about earlier, which, you know, the shortage is really impacting the auto industry, we've evolved to a model where a great deal of the design is in the United States, in California, very much so. And a lot of the manufacturing has gone over to Asia because they're better at it. They're more tolerant of the very large capital investments that you need. Okay, so what you have, for example, if you look at, say, a microprocessor chip or maybe a chip that is used in your iPhone, it may be designed in California. It may be manufactured in Taiwan using equipment made in the United States or made in Europe, and materials that come from China, Japan, Europe, the US, all over, right? And with that specialization, we end up with lower cost products because everybody does what they do best.
You know, what the pandemic has done is really just exacerbated challenges that existed obviously before 2020. When it comes to supply chains, when it comes to industry practices, what left companies ill-prepared to handle really the unprecedented disruptions that we've been experiencing since last year?
Vicky, I think the biggest issue has been visibility. And when we talk about supply chains and I talk about that specialization, you can think of, for example, somebody who assembles iPhones for Apple, okay? And they will in turn rely on a set of suppliers who will provide, for example, the batteries or the display screen or, you know, the communications chips and so on. And those in turn will rely on other suppliers. So many products these days have a tiered structure where you have suppliers feeding suppliers who feed the ultimate producer. Okay. And the problem with that is it's really hard to know who all those suppliers are. So when we had the initial shock from COVID-19 and China shut down, a lot of manufacturers were surprised that some of their key components came from China. And they might have, for example, in pharmaceuticals, it may have been an active ingredient that came from China that went to India, where it was put into the final form and then shipped to the US. So that kind of complexity and lack of visibility led to a lot of surprise shortages. So I think that's been one of the great learnings, which is I really need to understand who is in my supply chain.
Is there now more of a discussion, or is the discussion evolving into, because you're talking about highly specialized companies, they're dedicating to doing one job better than anyone else, and then you have subcontractors who have subcontractors of their own, and understanding kind of all the workings that gets a product that really is relying on multiple countries and continents. Is there discussion about maybe diversifying what you're making to prevent this from happening in the future?
Yeah, there is a lot of discussion about diversifying that risk, especially in the case where a lot of suppliers found out, when you go down multiple tiers, they all ended up at one place, for example. All right. So there's a lot of thoughts about diversification, but that takes time. The thoughts about diversification actually started before the pandemic with the trade war between the U.S. and China, as a lot of firms thought about the geopolitical risk. And they said, well, you know, I need to diversify more. And so maybe I need to source more out of Southeast Asia or somewhere like that. You already saw firms diversifying then because of tariffs or otherwise, especially, for example, in the furniture industry or garments and textiles, sort of very labor intensive manufacturing with a lot of handwork. That trend had already started before the pandemic. Interestingly, during the pandemic, because China got the pandemic under control much faster than many other countries, some of that manufacturing actually returned to China because it was the easiest thing to do. And so, since last August, we've seen this import surge, particularly from China, like we've never seen before, because they were the reliable manufacturer. And so that's kind of flown in the face of diversification. But I think most firms now realize this is a major issue because a lot of them have suffered from losing sales for inability to get the merchandise.
Are companies also shifting perhaps to production closer to home?
Well, there's a lot of talk about that. I'm actually a little skeptical of that because it takes a long time and it's hard work to do things like that. Countries like Mexico are seeing benefit because they are relatively low cost. So some production coming out of Asia to be closer to the U.S. Is going to Mexico. And Mexico is relatively low cost and it has that geographic proximity, which is a huge advantage for them.
Finally, we're now in the kind of newest chapter of the pandemic. California reopened last week. People are going out and they're buying things and they're buying different things. What are you interested in seeing how this develops, these supply chain issues and just really, what people want and how... and and how they can get them and the challenges that arise from that?
Well, my prediction, okay, and this is probably a little counterintuitive, but one of the things I'm telling people is we should look at all that inventory in the pipeline, right? There still are ships off Los Angeles, Long Beach, where the, you know, they haven't been able to unload. The port complex there has done a good job in trying to catch up. But, you know, there's an enormous backlog in southern China right now because they had a COVID outbreak at one of the major export terminal in southern China. And the containers are actually building up. In other words, they're piling up at the terminal faster than they can get them on ships. Okay, what that means is there is a lot of furniture, household goods, toys, what have you, that have been ordered that are coming at us, you know, whether we want them or not. Now, as we see those buying patterns shift as California opens up, you know, the question in my mind is like, will that demand still be there for those goods when they arrive here? Now, we saw what happened in lumber last week as, you know, prices suddenly dropped as people, you know, realized, well, maybe I need to do other things and spend money on other things. So that'll be something that's very interesting to watch coming up. I'm predicting it'll be a good season for sales as we have excess merchandise that we couldn't get when we wanted finally showing up on our shores.
Willie Shih is an economist with Harvard Business School. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, still ahead, how COVID is affecting nature and wildlife, from migrational patterns and animal relocations to disrupted research and conservation efforts. You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment.
Hi there. If you're enjoying Insight, we think you'll love our podcast, Blue Dot, with your host, that's me, Dave Shlohm. Every week, we take a deep dive into science and nature, from the search for life beyond our pale blue dot in the vastness of space to the ecosystems we all depend on. You never know what you'll hear, from the physics of Leonardo da Vinci to communications with humpback whales. Check out Blue Dot wherever you get your podcasts.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicki Gonzalez. A certain type of news story started to spring up early on in the pandemic when much of the world went into lockdown. The idea that, in the absence of people, nature and wildlife as we know it was returning to a healthier state. There were reports of dolphins in the canals of Venice, Italy, pumas in the streets of Santiago, Chile, and many animals as a whole were seemingly reclaiming various urban environments from normally human-populated areas, including those here in California. But new research shows that the true effect of COVID has turned out to be much more complex. Rebecca Shaw is the chief scientist and senior vice president for the World Wildlife Fund, which is an international organization advocating for wilderness prevention and reducing human impact on the environment. Welcome to Insight, Rebecca.
Thank you so much for having me, Vicki. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, Rebecca, what are some of the biggest ways the pandemic has affected wildlife and nature?
Well, you highlighted some examples really early on, stories about wildlife just going crazy and rebounding and taking over habitat that they had fled from before. But the truth is, the story of how nature and wildlife have responded is much, much more complex, as you can imagine. In some cases, they've really benefited from the reduced pollution, both air and water pollution as industrial practices sort of declined and manufacturing declined. There was, of course, people weren't going anywhere, so there was less litter, there was less plastic being put in the ocean. And of course, the beaches were not filled with people, and therefore there were places for turtles, say, to lay their eggs. And certainly they, in Florida, we saw that beach closures led to some nesting for some loggerhead turtles. So there was some of that rebounding of nature. But there were also downsides. And I think that the downsides were not as intuitive. The lockdowns across the planet disrupted conservation efforts, research efforts, enforcement in protected areas and parks. And when that enforcement went down, then illegal hunting and illegal fishing increased. And so you really saw two sides of nature coming back, but then nature being pushed back again by increased fishing and hunting efforts across the globe. And often by those who are less advanced, you know, the disadvantaged, who really were just looking for food, who needed to hunt wildlife for just basic nutrition on a daily basis because they lost their jobs or because there was no, their food sources were cut off.
Which animals or animal groups have been most affected?
I think that's a really hard question to answer. But I think that if you think about different regions and the way in which humans interact with nature and interact with wildlife in different regions, the tropics in general were the hardest hit. It's the place where you have the highest diversity of species and the most people dependent on wildlife for nutrition and just as a regular food source. When the pandemic hit and people lost their jobs in the cities in the tropical regions, many of them went home to rural areas, and it increased the pressure. And so we saw impacts on all types of species that were consumption species throughout the tropics, including birds, including mammals and fish.
How did the impact differ? Looking at California, how did the effects from COVID play out in our state?
COVID in California, I think, is one of the places where it actually benefited. For a short time, when people were at home, there was a rebound of wildlife into some of the parks and the state parks and the national parks where people were not allowed in, and therefore wildlife could really take over, particularly the big species. But then as we got anxious and restless and needed to get outside, we went outside in numbers we have never seen before. So it was really a positive sign that people were getting out in nature and appreciating nature. But we also saw the impacts in those parks and on those beaches of all those people and a decline in wildlife in those places because of it.
You know, we're talking about animals that are reclaiming their land and are rebounding. But now that the pandemic is as I mentioned in its latest chapter, you know, California reopened last week and other states are reopening as well. People are returning to areas that have been reclaimed by animals. What are you concerned about moving forward?
I think one of the things to really keep in mind is that it's really important that we have maintain our balance with nature in general. One of the things that many people might not realize is that this coronavirus comes from wildlife, and it's our out of balance relationship with nature that allows for the kind of spillovers from animal diseases to become human diseases to create pandemics like this. And so one of the things I think we need to be reminded of as we get our economies going and we get back, we really need to build back better. And that's a phrase you'll hear over and over again. But when you hear that, it means we need our protected areas. We need our parks. We need places where nature can thrive, where all the services it provides to humans, like clean air and clean water and healthy soils. We need to be able to take care of that to maintain the balance that keeps those diseases from spilling over. At the same time, we're growing our economies. And so it's really a chance to rethink about we have come back up into full speed and how we do that differently. And I really like the previous discussion about supply chains, because if you think about nature's and nature's supply chains and what it supplies, we really need to think about supporting all the services, and many of those services from nature come from intact landscapes and seascapes.
Hopefully this is a renowned wake-up call.
Yeah, that's what I would hope as well.
Rebecca Shaw is the Chief Scientist and Senior Vice President for the World Wildlife Fund. Thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much, Vicki.
Well, that is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Thank you to producers Cynthia Lopez and Kyle McKinnon, with managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, Helga Salinas, and Megan Minata. Cap Radio's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer, Antonio Munez. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. And I'm Vicki Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.